This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This was a telegraphed attack by Iran, but I think when we look at it, what they really tried to do is telegraph it to the countries in the region, so the Saudis, the Jordanians, so that there was no accidental conflict there. I think we believe that they were surprised by how quickly this intelligence went to the U.S. But on the other hand, make no mistake about this. This was 300 some odd drones, missiles. This was a full-scale attack.
Hi, and welcome to Wealthion. I'm James Conner, and today my guest is Peter Chur, and Peter is the head of macro strategy at Academy Securities. And we're going to get his views on what's happening in the Middle East and also how these events are impacting or will impact the global economy. Hi, Peter. Thank you very much for joining us today. How are things in Connecticut?
Not too bad. Keeping busy, certainly, with everything that's going on across the globe.
So, Peter, Academy Securities has a very unique history, and its founders are all military or ex-military. Maybe you can give us a little bit of background on the firm.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it started post 9/11, and it was the first post 9/11 veteran-based firm. About 50% of the staff is veteran. We try and keep it that way. I am not a veteran. I did not serve. In fact, the running joke is I'm the token pacifist being Canadian, but you know, we survived through that. Our entire C-suite is veterans. Our president, many people know, Phil McConkie, former New York Giant, who's also a Naval Academy grad. And within that, we also have a subset, which we rely very heavily on. We call it our geopolitical intelligence group. And it's now 20 retired generals, admirals, and two astronauts who really inform us on the geopolitical side of things. And it's been really neat because I can take what I've always done from a macro side, and I still do that. But more often than not, I'm able to incorporate what's going on geopolitically. And I think we have unique insights. And that's been really important the last few weeks as we're navigating what's going on in the Middle East.
Fascinating background on your firm. And this is why I want to talk to you to tap into this knowledge. And I want to get your views on what happened this past weekend. And I want to hear from you how you think Israel will retaliate against the Iranians for the drone attacks.
Yeah, so obviously this was a telegraphed attack by Iran. But I think when we look at it, what they really tried to do is telegraph it to the countries in the region, so the Saudis, the Jordanians, so that there was no accidental conflict there. I think we believe that they were surprised by how quickly this intelligence went to the U.S. But on the other hand, make no mistake about this. This was 300 some odd drones, missiles. This was a full-scale attack. And we believe it's going to be incredibly difficult for Israel to ignore this, right? This is not one or two that were kind of tossed randomly hoping to miss. This was a pretty full-scale attack. The fact that it failed shouldn't count that much, right? We still charge people with attempted murder in this country, right? So the fact that they tried this attack, I think it's going to be very difficult. We believe that Israel will have to respond. Our thing right now is it's more about when, not if they will respond, because you really can't set a precedent of allowing a foreign country to attack your soil and not respond. However, we do think it'll be a targeted response. It may do something to go after anything that could maybe promote regime change. I think the only positive that came out of this whole weekend was you saw how the Saudis, how the rest of the Middle East reacted. Iran stands probably more alone than they realized. So if you can target things that might trigger a regime change, that could be good. Going back in time, right, a lot of the Iranians are very unhappy with their own leadership. They don't want to be part of this kind of, you know, restrained country. So maybe something good could happen to that. We're also on the eye for probably cyber and other types of attacks on the nuclear facilities, because that's going to be a big area that Israel wants to watch out for, is where does Iran stand on their nuclear capabilities and how do we shut that down if this is going to escalate?
And so I just want to clarify a couple of points you just made. So first of all, there's no diplomatic relationships between the U.S. and Iran, correct?
Correct. No official one. So everything goes back channels in theory. So I think that's how most of the negotiations have been going.
So there would have been no communication through the back channels about this drone attack?
No, we believe that it was all sent directly from the Saudis and other, you know, Gulf countries to the U.S. and to Israel. That's what allowed the defense to be so successful. And it was a very successful defense. And the other thing that does come up is, you know, this is where it gets tricky too, is we spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on the defense. Their attack is relatively inexpensive, right? A lot of the missiles that we use cost $1 million a pop. So this is great, but I think we've been talking more and more about this. We see it going on a little bit, even in Russia and Ukraine, is we have very sophisticated equipment, but it's costly. And it becomes ineffective to take $1 million missiles to knock out $20,000 drones. At some point, that becomes a losing battle.
And so even though the Iranians would not want to communicate with the U.S. about what they were doing, why would they want to communicate with their neighbors? Or why would they want to tell anybody? Why wouldn't they want to take advantage of the element of surprise?
You know, and all these things, accidental conflict is one of the biggest risks they take. I think when we look at what is happening even within Taiwan and China, right? They're trying to promote almost this accidental contact. So Iran's going to be flying through some of their airspaces. They wanted, I think, these countries to be well aware of this so that they didn't accidentally hit a Saudi jet fighter or anything like that. So I think they were actually trying to be cautious and make sure that they didn't surprise any of their people who I think they thought were more allies. And I think it turned out they're not really allies to Iran right now. Many in that region would like the Iranian government switched anyways. So I think that's probably more of what happened than this was meant to be well telegraphed to the U.S. I think it was meant to be well telegraphed to avoid any sort of accident in the air as the attack was occurring.
So 99% of the drones and missiles were ineffective. And do you think that was done purposely by the Iranians? Like maybe they're just trying to send a message to Israel?
You know, we don't think so. I think a couple of our generals have spent some time analyzing the, missiles that were sent over. These are supposedly some of their better missiles. These were drones that they use. There's some estimates that as many as 50% of the drones actually failed at launch. So I think what you're seeing a little bit is the Iranian military has really dedicated their entire money to missiles, these drones, and it's questionable how effective they are or aren't. We've seen some of those same issues, I think, even when Russia's been trying to use them. So we think this was actually meant to be an attack that was successful. And they're probably very back on their heels. And that's probably one of the reasons they were very quick to say they're done, because we think they were surprised by how little got through.
And this event that happened, it was a result of the Israelis attacking the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Why did Israel attack that embassy?
You know, I think, not to get biblical, but I think this is one of those where you start talking about an eye for an eye, and now we keep trying to figure out where did the first eye come from. And the reality is Hamas is supported by Iran. Without Iranian support, Hamas would not exist as the fighting force they are. Similar with what's going on with the Houthis, a lot of their weaponry, almost all their weaponry is supplied by Iran, probably some of their targeting, some of their information. So it's almost unfair to say that Israel prompted this by going after these Iranian targets, when I think Israel would view it as, okay, this is retaliation for what's going on. And you go back in time when President Trump, took out Soleimani, and Soleimani, all our generals hated him as an individual, right? He was an evil person, but they would all say that he was very effective at what he did, managing these proxies, getting the proxies to do their bidding. So it was an important thing we took. It slowed them down. And if you go back at that time, Iran did respond. They hit one of our bases in Iraq, but it was very limited attack, right? It wasn't 300 Soleimani missiles. I think it was a half dozen sort of things. It was a very weak, poorly led attack. And that's why I think we're saying this is different. This was so many missiles that if they wanted to do something just for show, it wouldn't have included that level of weaponry that they actually used. So that's why we think Israel has to take this seriously. And Iran's more back on their heels because it failed, not because it purposely failed.
And so, I'm sorry, what do you think the follow-up is going to be from Israel?
We think they are going to try and target something, whether it's more on the cyber side, whether it's more a high-level leader. We don't think they're going to do a full response, right? Had the attack been more successful, I think you would have immediately seen jet fighters scramble and a big airstrike into that. Away from that, I would say a lot of our discussions now with our client base, and we mostly talk to large corporations, large asset managers, people are like, okay, so the one kind of overhanging threat that no one's quite sure what to do with is nuclear capacity that Iran has. They even kind of threatened that they might use either nuclear or hypersonic in their next attack, I believe overnight, when they said, the next attack will include weapons they haven't used before, We're not sure where they stand on nuclear. We're also, you know, I think this is where it gets very tricky. I would say to the amount that our generals and admirals know, Israel does not have the capability by themselves to take out the Iranian nuclear facilities. So we would probably have to get directly involved. And that could be a friction. It's unclear whether they have the missile technology and the bombs and the delivery mechanisms that we have that we could take out those deeply buried bunkers. So that gets very tricky. That's why I think we're leaning again to more cyber response in terms of what they try and do to slow down Iranian nuclear production.
And what do you think the Biden administration is doing currently behind the scenes?
You know, I think the one thing that we're questioning is what's going on behind the scenes versus what's front and center. And I would say that most of our geopolitical advisors kind of were surprised that we would come out and immediately say we would not support an Israeli counterattack, because we kind of look at deterrence, right? And everything that you do in the military is always both to send a message and to flex your muscles and create some element of deterrence, right? Actually having, you know, conflict is really not on anyone's interest, right? No one wants it. No, it's death. It's awful. So deterrence is such a big part of that, and whether it's a nuclear deterrence or traditional. So I think by taking chips off the table, seemingly unnecessary, and you look again overnight, Iran's coming back saying they will respond heavily, right? So they're trying to keep that threat high. So we've always understood in the past, and you know, again, our generals will tell, any time that we are supplying weaponry, you know, military intelligence and aid to countries, they always come with strings attached, with rules of what we want. But most of those are conducted back channel and rarely so upfront. And so I think that's something everyone in our sphere is trying to figure out. Why were we so quick to say, Israel, you're not allowed to attack Iran back, when I think, quite frankly, right, if Andrews Air Force Base had been attacked, even if it was an unsuccessful attack, we wouldn't want to just do nothing.
Yes, very good points. So I want to ask you about the oil price now, and oil is trading in the mid-80s, and I'm surprised it didn't catch more of a bid on the back of this. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, we think oil is going to maintain, you know, relatively high prices. I think there's a chance it spikes to, you know, $100 on Brent, maybe 105. I think the one thing that's helping mitigate oil prices is, one, the Saudis have a lot of potential production they could put back on the market. We think they do that somewhere above 100, right? And the one concern about that had been, well, if the Saudis are really aligning with Iran, maybe they wouldn't help us in the event that you get an oil spike. But given what we saw this past weekend, I think it's pretty clear the Saudis, and they've invested a lot, right? They were part of the Abraham Accords. I think the Saudis want to westernize. And then the other side, I think, you know, this is almost a little bit depressing, I think, when you think about it. It's just become very clear that politically as a nation, inflation has become our Achilles heel. And we're so worried about energy prices, right? One, we did not refill the SPR. So we had an opportunity maybe to refill it more than we did. We did not do that. You look at what we're telling the Ukrainians. We're telling the Ukrainians not to target Russian energy facilities, right? Because we want there. And even within what we see in the Middle East, by the sources we talk to, there's about 3.5 million barrels of oil per day being sold by Iran, mostly into China, some into India. That's well above levels we have them sanctioned for. Most of that is being shipped on carriers that are either Chinese related. So you kind of know they're so we have been unwilling to stop those. So again, we've kind of turned this blind eye to Iranian production. You know, many wonder, well, how are they funding their war efforts and the funding of the proxies? There's a lot of this oil on the market. And I think that's been the biggest thing that we've seen. I think domestic policy is trying to do everything not to have to clamp down on Iran, because that would push oil. So I think we're going to see oil there. And domestically, I think we're seeing oil and energy use increase anyways. You know, the prevalence of data centers, I think, is huge, right? You're starting to see more and more demand. We talked to a lot of people who are building out tech infrastructure, including the data centers, and getting reliable energy is one of the biggest problems they're finding when citing this. And what we find interesting, we have one admiral, she's been great. She was actually in charge of naval cyber attack capacity. So, you know, most people in the cyber world are off the defense side. So she has a pretty unique side from looking at the cyber frack. But we've been recommending to clients, I think people are taking it very seriously. If you have data centers, you want them domestically based. You want local employees working on these. It's not going to protect you from cyber completely, but it reduces that risk. So things like cryptocurrencies where the mining's headed offshore, I think data center, data storage, data processing is going to become more and more domestic. That's going to drive energy demand in this country. So I think there's a lot of good reasons to buy energy separate from what's going on in the Middle East. And I almost think you get the geopolitical spike risk for free right now.
Okay, a couple of points. First of all, how many barrels does Iran produce daily?
We believe it's around 3.5 million. And that's talking to several, I've got some very good sources within the energy side. So that's, you know, outside of our normal scope. But the people that I trust who've been very good are saying that. And our sanction level is, I think, below 1 million or something. So there's this huge gap in what is being shipped. Over the past month, I think we've tried to stop a few ships that were flagged under nations we felt we could stop. But this is really an ongoing, you know, thing we've allowed to slide.
So you mentioned that you think oil prices are going to drift higher. And I know you talked about data centers, but that's more longer term. What about in the short term here, like as we head into summer? If we have WTI trading around $85, where do you see it going up to 100?
You know, I think on a spike, we can get to maybe 95, maybe to 100. I think on the downside, though, you're probably 75, 80. So I feel we're in this much higher band for the next, you know, 6 months to a year. And again, I think here we're seeing this kind of realization that not only do we have to build out sustainable energy faster than we thought and more aggressively, you're seeing states like Michigan institute some rules where people were using siting and saying, well, I don't like the sight of this windmill, so we can't do it. And now there's timing to push that through. So you're going to see, I think, a lot of commodity demand as we build out sustainable energy. And I think really for the first time, I'm quite happy about this. I feel like in the last 6 months, there's this realization we're going to need traditional energy sources for the next 10, 20, 30 years. So there's some investment in that. You know, I've always said probably for the last 3 or 4 years, and knock on wood, it's been working well, is the energy companies of the future are probably the energy companies of today, right? They've got the PhDs, they've got the skills at pulling energy out of this earth. How they pull it out will shift over time. But so that's why I'm so bullish on the sector in particular. I'm probably more bullish on the stocks even than the commodity, but that's my favorite place to be right now with all the geopolitical things going on.
So I want to go back and look at the Middle East and get your views on if you think this can escalate, right? And we had two oil price shocks in the 1970s, one in 1973 from the oil embargo, one in 1979 from the Iranian Revolution. Both resulted in significantly higher oil prices. Do you envision a scenario like this happening now?
You know,
like sometime this year, sometime next year, if things do escalate in the Middle
East? Yeah, and so we've been talking about both escalation and expansion. And so I think now you're seeing both, right? Expansion of the number of nations directly involved, right? Up until this weekend, you had not had Iran and Israel directly attack each other. So that's kind of that expansion as well as escalation. I think there is a real risk that at some point we decide we have to do something to stop this. And we, maybe it's us, maybe it's Israel. It's going to be very difficult to stop the container ships because I think that would bring us almost in direct confrontation to China, right? Most of the oil is going to China. Stopping these ships that are carrying the oil to China, I think, could be very diplomatically problematic, especially as, you know, Yellen's over there trying to get some sort of trade normalization going on, which we don't think is going to be particularly successful. So do you wind up attacking some of these oil fields? Does something happen to create a real disruption? Does Ukraine, for example, decide, well, maybe they put pressure on the U.S. by attacking Russian oil fields more directly? And I just feel that overall, our enemies in particular know that this inflation has become our Achilles heel. And if you want the incumbents to lose, you would create an oil shock, right? Because as we saw, you know, coming into the midterms and things like that, the incumbents do not do well during inflation spikes. So I don't know what other countries will be motivated to do. But yeah, I think there's a risk that we're almost back, unfortunately, to where we were. It felt like 20 years ago or 10 years ago, we kind of were self-sufficient and it didn't matter as much what went on in the Middle East. And somehow it seems like we've lost that. Even though we're relatively self-sufficient, we're not wholly self-sufficient. And it's a little bit scary to me that so much seems to depend on the price of oil and so little of that's truly in our control at this point for the next 6 months.
Yes, I have to admit I follow a lot of commodities, but I find the oil market the most interesting of all commodities just because of the geopolitical aspects. It can be very volatile.
Yeah, and it's, you know, about 2 years ago, and I think we were premature, we always talked about, okay, when you've got the geopolitical overlay that we have, you could take a look at where oil was and that's where U.S. interests were. And we felt that was shifting towards where cobalt, lithium, where the rare earths and critical minerals were. And I think some of that is true, because those are going to be kind of the important ones in the future. But honestly, I think we all took our eye off the ball of just how important oil still is today, and that we kind of lost a lot of interest in those regions. One thing I've completely learned since I've been at Academy that I think is relevant about this is the term business follows the flag. And I think historically what that was meant, we plant our flag somewhere and it creates an environment that's conducive to business, right? There's law, there's order, there's, things that you can have expectations. And unfortunately, I think for the last 20 years, we've been taking that flag and pulling it closer to home, and it's creating this kind of spaces where bad things happening. It allows different actors to come in. And we've been, to some extent, I think very handcuffed by our own rules. When we had that kind of economic friction with the Soviet Union, they were awful militarily. We often talk about the dime framework of geopolitics. So diplomacy, information, military, and economic. And Russia was no good at diplomacy. They were very good at information, allegedly very good at military. Now we're all questioning that. Economic, they were nowhere. China has used that economic power to really work closely and develop a lot of tight relationships with these autocratic resource-rich nations. And I think that's, when you look at all these flow issues we're talking about, it's not coincident that it's the U.S. and the West that's having their commodity flows disrupted while China manages to kind of go on with limited risk, and India as well.
Interesting points. Peter, as we wrap up, maybe you can summarize for our viewers what they should be aware of in the coming days and weeks and what might happen.
I think this really comes down to this whole escalation. I think anytime I would fade almost any move when you hear about some sort of peace talks occurring. This is awful and even hard to say, but our generals probably believe it's unlikely the hostages will return because they've been held captive for so long. Who knows what shape they are in? It's unlikely they're in a shape that they actually want presented back to the West. So we think there's very limited ability to have a peace or a truce that works for both sides. So we think we see this grind on. We think the battles are incredibly hard. I think our generals would say from their work and what they look at, Israel has been very cautious. It's just very difficult to fight in these places, especially when the enemy is violating the Geneva Convention by putting command and control centers under hospitals, et cetera. So we don't expect this to end anytime soon, which is why, again, I think you're going to see pressure on oil. I'm very negative on yields. That's one thing I would say. Traditionally, you get these kind of flight to safety moves, and we saw a little bit of that last Friday where stocks fell, but treasuries rallied. We're back to where we've been, I think, recently, where treasury yields going higher, because normally this flight to safety, you see the economic slowdown, and that makes everyone want to buy treasuries. I think partly we've separated enough already that it's not going to help as much in that respect. People are going to see oil spike. That's bad for inflation. And then I think there's this real risk that everyone's going to start across the globe spending more and more on military, which might be the right solution to this. But that is going to run up these deficits even higher. So I think we see the 10-year get to 5% even with a kind of geopolitical event, which is very unusual. So that's why I've been targeting being long energy as my best hedge for geopolitical risk. And I've been short, to be honest, some of the NASDAQ stocks.
Interesting points. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for sharing your thoughts today. And if somebody would like to learn more about you and your firm, where can they go?
So www.academysecurities.com. We've got our advisory work. You can read about our board. You can see the geopolitical research we put out. We put out one T report at least a week, which is my work. It's more macro and probably one during the week. And we put out sit reps, which situation reports. So every time one of these comes out, we are able to put something together, what's important. And we typically have two or three generals respond. And then we do have an asset management side, which has an interesting ETF, VETZ, I let the Canadian slip in. But it actually invests in mortgages that go to veterans. And so that's been an interesting way where we're, again, trying to support, and some of the fees go to charities. So we're trying to make this, I think, we live, I guess we call it mission driven, where we want to be authentic to our mission and add capabilities and kind of compete within this DEI space in a unique way.
Well, that was a great overview. And once again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Peter Chair and hearing his views on the Middle East and how things might evolve in the coming weeks. During times of economic uncertainty, like we're going through right now, physical gold is one way to help prepare for uncertainty. And if you would like to learn more about purchasing gold and how to own it and also how to store it, consider visiting our sister company, HardAssetsAlliance.com. It has over $3 billion in assets and is used by over 100,000 clients worldwide. And there's a link below in the show notes. Once again, I want to thank you for being with us today, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you.